And I don't know, I can't say good afternoon and I can't say good morning because it's 12 noon. It's that nether world in between. Good afternoon, I guess, because it's now 12:01 Eastern time. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Q&A edition of Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. We do the regular show Monday through Friday for all of the news analysis you need and commentary thereabout. And then also on Mondays and Wednesdays at 12 noon, we do this supplementary program during which we ask you to please submit your questions, comments, etc. And we are here to serve and to answer you as best we can. We will be here for probably the full hour. That's usually the way these things go. No promises, but I think that's how it's going to be. If you have a question and you're watching live on YouTube or Rumble, go ahead and put the questions in. Robbie West, our producer, will put them up. If you have a question for Robbie or myself or for Jamarl, please, or all of us, go ahead and put it up. Comments are welcome too. Basically, this is a free fire zone. And so it'll be, it's imagine like you're an IDF soldier in Gaza. There's no rules. You can do anything you want. There's and you won't be and you won't be held accountable for anything. It's that fun.
Yes,
Except
exactly.
and you're not even hurting anyone, probably, except maybe my feelings. And you know, really, does anyone even know if those exist? So, all right. So thanks for tuning in. Trying to think what else I got to tell you. Probably not much. Am I missing anything, JT?
No, let's light this candle.
All right, let's rock. Okay, so first question from Manchild. Thanks very much for the $2. Utah approved a Manhattan-sized data center. How does tech ethically justify destroying vital ecosystems for profit? Is corporate greed colonizing our resources under the guise of digital progress? JT, I'll let you take your stab at that one first because it's a good one.
I don't even understand the question, to be honest. I
Really?
mean, but honestly, do you really think that they look at it and say to themselves, "Oh my God, we're destroying the ecosystem by building these things. Oh my God, how do we justify the they justify it with huge amounts of cash. That's how they justify it. I'm getting a massive amount of cash for doing this particular task. That is my job. That is, I am building a machine that creates cash. That's how they justify it. There is no justification for it. They don't feel the need to justify it. Like, it's not even like that's just, that question will make no sense to them. I hope you get it. Right? They're like, what? What do you mean? What are you talking about?
It's completely
Destroying ecosystems. What
irrelevant.
do you mean justify? Why do I need to justify it? I'm making millions of dollars. What do you mean justify it? They don't need to.
Yeah.
It matters to us. It doesn't matter to them.
No, it does not matter to them at all. I mean, how do they justify it? I guess, yeah, you're right. They don't have to justify it because nobody holds them accountable, right?
Right.
I mean, obviously the appropriate envelopes changed hands in the Utah State Legislature and at whatever Utah Environmental Regulatory Agency is supposed to watch out for the delicate ecosystem of the state of Utah and obviously hasn't been doing that.
Right.
It's up to the people of Utah to yell and scream and break things and hold demonstrations that are not just every 4 months on a Saturday when nobody's around, weather allowing. It's time, you know, it's they have to, they have, if they care about this, I would imagine a lot of people in Utah do care about the environment, maybe more than in other states. I mean, you know, it's the West. You know, it's you don't live there because of the vibrant, you know, club culture. You know, you live there because it's outdoors and it's pretty and you care about those things.
Well, and you can
So
have fab laughs, that too.
I mean, there's no jobs involved here, right? I mean, nobody, there are no jobs in these data centers. So it's weird. Yeah.
Somebody licked a credit card, rubbed it down a congressman's ass cheeks, and the legislature passed. What?
Yeah, you know, I mean, when was the, I mean, I remember the first time I realized that, you know, as Leonard Cohen sings, everybody knows the game is fixed, right? Like, Everyone knows. It's like I realized it when I was a page in city council in Kettering, Ohio, and there was a proposal to tear down the remnants of a 1800 early 1800s orchard that had become overgrown, and it was basically kind of a de facto park for all of us kids who used to run around and look at the beavers and run through the creeks and look for fossils, and you know, it was really kind of great, like the closest we got to be like Tom Sawyer, like in, you know, that environment. And they wanted to turn it into a strip mall, tear it all down. And it was like there was another strip mall quarter of a mile away. It's not exactly like there was not enough shopping anywhere nearby, right? You could easily like walk on your hands and knees to the nearest strip mall. But anyway, so the community didn't want it. We all go to the city council meeting, and you could just sort of tell by the, even as a 15-year-old, I could tell by the way that the councilmen looked at each other. Everyone knows the fix is in. And obviously the developer had distributed the appropriate number of chubby envelopes, and they just went in there. And it's like, yeah, they let us all say our piece, and then they voted unanimously, and everyone there was against it, and every councilman was for it, and that was that.
We have a, I think people need to realize when you have a system that is a capitalistic system, and I know they often talk about it in the context of democracy or democratic or representative government, and they try to make it as if that part is the part of significance and priority. But it's not. I mean, it doesn't work that way in practice. I mean, it might have started off that way, but these it's almost like a cancer preying on the political democratic will of the population. And over again, if it comes between, hey, people want this versus money interest wants X, money interest is typically going to win out unless there is a hell of a uproar in regards to what is taking place. And even then, it may not necessarily. I mean, look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? Obama was running from, I mean, Hillary Clinton was running from. She was doing everything in her power to run from it. Obama was like, yeah, I know the American public is against this. I know this is going to overrule our courts and everything else. I know all that. I know all that. I get that. But this is, we still got to do this. And even Clinton, despite the fact that she was like, well, we're going to, you know, we're not going to do it. We're just going to make changes and we're going to call it something else. Meaning even she was going to do it, despite the fact that she was running from it because she knew the public was against it. Trump came and put a bullet in it because he didn't care one way or the other about it, but still tried to find other ways to get back to going after China. I guess I'm saying when money interest is at stake, public will takes an L often, unless public will is just obscene, like over the top.
Yeah,
Agree.
totally
Yes.
agree. Okay, next question, and more of a comment, but PW Walker, thanks for the donation. The USA spends more than the next 10 nations combined on quote unquote defense and scare quotes, eight of which are allies. I do like the fact that eight of which are allies is an interesting side note, right? I
It's
mean,
true.
if we have, if I mean, you know, if we have these allies, then logically, in a pinch, we would be able to count on them, and they would be able, and they would, we maybe wouldn't have to spend that much, have to spend that much.
Yeah, but who are these allies? I mean, if you think about it, China spends number two, I think they're like maybe 300 billion. Then you get Russia, I think at like 80 billion, maybe 90 billion, give or take. And then the rest, like Britain, France, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are minor powers at best. I mean, we don't have peers in this case. Like, meaning, how can I say this? Those powers are very minor in comparison to what the US spends. The United States spends, what, 100, I mean, 1 trillion, trying to go to 1.5 trillion. And China is number two with like 300 billion, which means that the US spends like, what, three times the amount, trying to go to like five times the amount that China spends on their military. And then the other powers are like Russia at 80 billion. I think the rub is bang for the buck. Are you getting bang for your buck? Or are these systems overpriced? Meaning, again, back to the capitalistic system thing, is the goal to create military equipment that can win wars decisively and big wars against major powers? Or are they building systems that are expensive to make cash? do we get a return on our investment is what I'm asking. And how do we know that we're getting a return on our investment, meaning that the systems that are built are suitable and adequate for the wars that we're fighting? Well, we can look at what's happening. The THAAD missile system, the Patriot system. Well, if those things worked to the degree that we're paying the money for, well, should the Gulf states be a wreck right now? Should Israel have gotten trashed in the way that they got trashed? Would Ukraine be getting trashed in the war against Russia? I'm trying to point out that these things are overpriced. Peace. And we could just pay nations. We could just keep the equipment and just pay nations to behave a particular way, as opposed to spending all of this money on the military equipment when all things being equal.
No doubt about that at all. Let me ask you this, and I'm not sure I understand this question, but since it's directed to you, I don't have to. Broomstick wants to know, Jamal, what do you think about Restore Britain?
What? Say it again. Restore Britain?
Restore Britain.
Oh, is that Nigel Farage's party?
Oh, I guess that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Restore UK, right?
Restore UK. Mm-hmm. I think that any political, no, there's no political party that's indispensable, right? Just like there's no nation that's indispensable. And the reality of it is, if you have centrist parties, and there's a reason for centrist parties. I mean, I'm pretty sure Ted will be able to, maybe you'll back me up on this, maybe you'll agree with this, that all things being equal, you don't want two political parties that are wildly out of sync. That all things being equal, you end up with two political parties that are in the center, because the idea is that those center parties is what keeps the government and everything consistent and coherent in regards to policy. But that can change if the environmental circumstances change. And in the context of those environmental circumstances changes, the public says, okay, we need something else. We need to reorganize ourselves. We need something else. We need new ideas in order to deal with the new environmental circumstance. Like you get, for example, in the UK, we'll fight them in the kitchens, we'll fight them, et cetera. Meaning Neville Chamberlain was not adequate to deal with Hitler. Winston Churchill was. Meaning Winston Churchill, in this very specific instance, was correct. Hitler is a problem, and appeasing him is not going to necessarily be the thing. Your government can make wild changes when the situation involves, or let's say when the environment is necessary for those changes. So if Britain is saying the Tories have failed miserably, and they're looking at Labour and saying Labour has also failed miserably with a Starmer government, they can change it. Like, that's not for me, right? That's for Britain to be like, okay, we've been royally fucked over with these main political parties. We need something different. The problem with America is that our political system fights tooth and nail to prevent that level of change and adjustment to the environmental circumstances. And I think what people thought that Donald Trump was that change, he was not. He was just another neoliberal neocon pretending to be something else. I don't have an issue with reform in the UK. I mean, they are the British public's reaction to the failures of Tory and Labour. That's what it is. At least that's my take on it, if I'm understanding the question correctly.
I don't have a lot to add to that. There's someone piggybacking on that question, maybe Bluth Funk. Thoughts on the potential future of Tommy Robinson in the UK?
He's not in jail. He's not in jail yet. I don't know. I don't have a take on Tommy Robinson. I mean, obviously, I don't like him. The guy, from my point of view, is racist.
Clearly.
Yeah, I don't have a take on him. I mean, look, I don't want political prosecutions, obviously. And people can be racist in a society that's open. So that's his right, I suppose. But do I have a take on him? No. I think he's a disgusting human being, personally.
I have nothing to add to that either. Is asking, is the future Star Trek, Star Wars, or Aliens? Obviously, you get to answer that question first.
Oh, that's a tough one. They should have added The Expanse. They should have added The Expanse. I probably would have picked The Expanse, unfortunately, even though I want Star Trek future. Because here's the thing, right? From my point of view, if the United States, or let's say if Earth comes across the ability to produce very cheap energy and can find a quirk in physics that allow them to do that, then you may be able to get an energy-based market, which is different than a financial-based market. Meaning, like for example, say for example, if we say every kid that's born will get X amount of dollars in their account every year, up until forever. And we as a government will do that because we want to eliminate poverty within the context of the country. And a productivity has reached a certain point. Well, we can do that. Maybe we have machines doing the labor, in which case machines give kickbacks. And so you may have a situation where every year there's $10,000 deposited in somebody's account. By the time they get to be, I don't know, 30, 40, they may have 100, 150,000 in their account. Let's say productivity continues to increase, in which case it goes from 10 to 20 to 30 to $40,000 a year. You may reach a point where work is optional because the productivity in society itself has effectively allowed it to be optional, or that people work until they're 30, in which case they just say fuck off and they don't have to necessarily do it anymore. They can do whatever they want with their life. Meaning you can conceivably come up with a societal idea, especially if you get productivity, or you get an economy that is based in something else where people have their means. Now you can make an argument that that is basically what Star Trek is, that they have an energy-based economy where they use energy credits with money working behind in the background, but the people don't really have to deal with the money part. And so when they go to restaurants, there's money in their account. That's not something that they necessarily take on per se. Meaning there's almost like a UBI that's working behind the scenes that if you're looking at it from the outskirts, it looks as if, well, these people don't have to work. The money is not an issue, et cetera. Where there is money, the mechanics is just happening behind the scenes. I'm saying you can conceive of a society like that, even if it's not necessarily a Star Trek society. Will we do that? Probably not. Maybe we have to, but I don't know if it looks like Star Trek or if it looks like The Expanse. And the UBI and The Expanse just made a lot of people lazy and made an earth where there was huge amounts of unemployment, huge amounts of people not being able to get the jobs that they wanted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Meaning The Expanse is far more complicated in the way that it operates. I think we'll probably end up in something like The Expanse, private enterprise in space, businesses in space. Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. But I obviously my want would be Star Trek.
Okay. I think that the future is aliens.
Oh, you think it's aliens?
Corporatism.
Oh, yeah. What The Expanse? That's The Expanse. As
Right.
corporations in space and shit like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Stupidly and unfortunately, because we're a dumb species. Manchild wants is asking, and this is a good question. Y'all talk about needing money to run the show, but we don't know how much money you're looking for to help keep the light on. How much support is needed? Can we do some telethon fundraisers? I'm gonna put Robbie on there for, why not? First of all, there's not gonna be any telethon fundraisers, right? But I guess it's we could do a telethon, right? Like I can be Jerry Lewis. I'm really good at whining and whinging. I can be like Robbie can be he can play the retarded child. And I can be like,
that.
please help little Robbie. Little Robbie needs your help. If little Robbie could die if you don't give us the $5,000 we need today. In fact, he will die on the air here.
But what's worse is that little Robbie believes in invisible sky people who he prays to.
Please help little Robbie. There's something wrong with little Robbie's brain.
Look, the sky people think, as I don't have an issue with religion, to be honest. I'm not an atheist at all, right? I think atheism and Christianity are very similar in the regards to this idea of having these certain ideas about what takes place after, as opposed to just saying, I don't know. But I don't have an issue with it because, again, I take the perspective that I don't know, right? I think the more specific you get, the more difficulty you get. It's that. which is why I go with the premise that I don't know. I mean, I believe in things like guides and stuff like that. And if you're in consciousness research, or if you're doing like OBEs, if you're doing like remote viewing and stuff like that, there's something there that we're just missing. So I'm not this atheist type person. It's just, you know, I just go with the premise. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to go down the religious rabbit hole, and I think Manchild's questions deserves to be answered. I mean, just for the record here, I have, as Robbie knows, I have no contempt for people who are religious, and I used to be one of them myself. So, you know, and so it's not like, no, I mean, I would say, honestly, it's not something I think about much. It just doesn't, it's not really, it's sort of like football. I don't care if people watch football, good for them. I hope they enjoy themselves. I don't watch football. I don't hate people who watch football. I don't hate football. I'm fine with football existing. I think it's a dangerous sport, but you know, probably, you know, I wish they did something about the head injury situation. But you know, I so it's like that. But you know, so the funding needs, right? Well, so I hate to be Weasley about it. The funding needs are kind of, this is kind of like pornography. You know it when you see it. Like in the last month that John was still here, this show was bringing in about $15,000 a month. So divided between me and John, that would have been enough to be sustaining and pay Robbie and pay Trent to help produce and do the thumbnails and all that. And there's also some back end expenses to like StreamYard and the other stuff that we use to keep this show going.
Right.
Do we need that much? Probably not, but we definitely, but I would say it's hard to justify doing this over a long period of time, unless you see an upward trajectory that to me feels like $4,000 each a month, maybe. I would say like $10,000 a month is kind of like where the show I think needs to be fully viable. Does it have to be next month? No, but you know, does it have to, but would it, does it have to be there within a year or two? Yeah, it does. You know, otherwise it's just not going to be viable. That's my opinion. I mean, the three of us have never really talked about what the benchmark is, but frankly, I think Manchild's right that like having a benchmark, like what is success? What is reasonable to me? The metric to me has always been like, I judged my cartooning career. Can I pay my bills doing what I want to do? That's all. And I live modestly. You know, I drive a 13-year-old car. I don't, you know, I'm cheap as shit. I'm the kind of guy, like if I'm flying, always coach, always economy plus out of LaGuardia. I park across the street in Jackson Heights and walk a mile and a half with my bag in the snow so as not to pay the $45 a night in overnight parking at LaGuardia. So, and I'm pretty sure JT's not exactly living the Hunter Biden lifestyle either. No, Robbie's not. So
I was trying.
I would say like, this is basically, this shit takes about a third to half of a work day, you know, between the research and all that stuff, the show prep and everything. So to me, it's hard to see doing it for under $4,000 per person per month. I mean, I don't know. That's like where I'm at. What do you guys think?
I work all day. Like, no bullshit. Like, from standpoint, like, and I think people, when they hear, oh, you guys do a channel, they think, oh, that's easy. And that's not the case. Most of the day is spent, like, for example, getting up at 5, doing the show until 9, then doing this show from 9 to 10, and then doing another show from 10 to et cetera, and then coming back and doing another show from 12 to et cetera. And then oftentimes I have guests after the fact. And so it's like you're doing research, you're booking guests, you're doing all that stuff. Like that's, it's a lot of work. That's the point that I'm trying to get across. And that will be with this show or with any other show that people are seeing being done. I mean, sure, there may be some lazy motherfuckers out there, but for all intents and purposes, we try to do good work here on this one and on any other show that we're effectively working on. Look, my standard is kind of like yours. Can I live? Like, can I make enough to pay the bills and keep the lights on? And as you point out, background expenses and those type of things, true. Balling, hell no. And even when I was traveling, the entire point of the travel was to cut expenses. Like, meaning I was going from place to place, but I was saving money as I was going from place to place because it was cheaper to do that as opposed to live in the States. So, you know, falling back to earth in America has not been the easiest thing in the world. But no, it's just enough to live. That's my standard on whether or not something is viable.
Well, it's that, and also from the back end standpoint. So if I kind of know how the sausage is made, we live stream on both Rumble and YouTube. On Rumble, we are a Rumble partner. On YouTube, we're monetized. So what does that mean in English? First of all, a paid channel subscriber is always going to be of more value than just a standard viewer. And so on Rumble, if you want to become a paid channel subscriber, it's $5 a month. You have to go to the Rumble website while we're live. You can't do it while we're not streaming. On the live stream tab, you click down where it says subscribe. You put in your credit card information, and you become a $5 a month subscriber. And that way you get access to all of the premium content and stuff that is that we have. With YouTube, you can become a channel subscriber anytime that you want. They call it a member. And on YouTube, you have different tiers. So it depends on what it is that you want, how much of it is that you want to contribute. That is ultimately going to be, on your respective platform, is going to be the best metric for us to have to be able to kind of budget anything out. Because otherwise, you're at the mercy of the viewer. And this is where YouTube and Rumble are significantly different. YouTube pays you by the click when it comes to ad revenue. So 1,000 people who watch a stream on YouTube is equivalent of about $1 for 1,000 people is how that works with ad revenue. Now, if someone skips the ad, you'll get paid. YouTube does, but the creator does not. If you let the ad run all the way through, then you both get paid. So with YouTube, it's squirrely, but also though YouTube has more ads than what Rumble has. If you're a Rumble partner like what we are, we're paid based off of watch hours. But Rumble doesn't have a set paycheck about how much does 1 hour translate to per dollars. This last month on Rumble, we had a banner month, and the paycheck was about 60% less than what it normally is. Why that is, I have no idea. Reach out to Rumble, I haven't got an answer. It just has to do with the market. Now, one thing I will tell you, just again, from a viewer perspective, the more people that watch, the more people that click the like button, the more people that share is going to push you up into a higher bracket where those metrics earn you more. That's one of the reasons why, like, for example, PutinBot Gaming, my gaming channel, earns less than what this show does because I have a smaller audience than what the program has here on Rumble. Conversely, when John Kiriakou was here, and y'all see the numbers on Rumble, y'all saw the numbers on YouTube. On Rumble, we had about 300 to 400 people watching live per show. That's no longer the case. John left, his audience evaporated. They're no longer here. As a result, we are paid less because the value we bring into the platform has gone down as a result.
Yeah, we paid less per viewer. Yeah,
correct. So what does that look like? I have no idea. Right now we're still kind of figuring that out. We're still trying to find the floor. But seriously, though, I mean, if you want to help the show, the three biggest ways.
Well, direct donations are far and away the most, are the biggest, yep. Are the biggest thing. So
100%.
Chats and Rumble rants. That money is massive. I mean, basically, like if you donate $10, I mean, that $10 is worth 10,000 viewers, you know, that we're not going to get, like, you know, in one episode. I mean, yeah. It's sort of analogous to like music, right? Like if I buy a CD directly from a band's website, that band is going to get like $15, right? In their pocket, cash money, right? I only have to pay like $17. They just have to ship it to me via media mail. But let's say I listen to them on Spotify or Pandora. They get a fraction of a penny, literally. It might be like 1/182nd of 1 cent. So Yeah, they have to have millions. So the equivalent of buying a CD from a website that belongs directly to a band is hundreds of thousands of listens. And so the power of a super chat or a Rumble rant is the same as that.
For sure. 100%. And also from a pure monetary standpoint, where if you become a channel subscriber on YouTube, YouTube takes 40% of that donation. So I say, if you go in and if you sign up for $20 a month to be a channel subscriber, YouTube off the top takes 40% of that. On Rumble, if someone becomes a Rumble subscriber for $5 a month, you get their premium content, and it's $5. Like I said, it's $5 a month, but Rumble does not take any of it. So that's going to be the breakdown. I mean,
is that true if you pay the $10 a month on Rumble?
Well, the $10 a month, what that's for is that's to become a Rumble premium subscriber, so we can see the premium content for all the shows. We get profit sharing for that. What that is, I have no idea. But it's that's not a direct. But that's not a direct donation.
You get a bigger share if you pay five. Then
correct. I mean that will pay more than anything else that you can do. But seriously though, I mean the biggest thing that you can do,
even with YouTube, if you have the ease of the donation, obviously it sucks that Google is getting that 40%. But the ease of the donation, if you're looking for, like, I don't have time to be thinking about all this, I just want to hit click.
It makes it easy.
That's the way. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. And if, I mean, ultimately, though, at the end of the day, direct donations, channel subscriptions are—they're going to be king, and that's one of the reasons why whenever we do these shows, the super chats are going to be high priority because those are people who are putting their money into keeping this show up and running.
And the vast majority of the money that was coming in under the Kiriakou period was coming in that way from Rumble chats, and
yeah, people have some questions about the CIA and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to answer questions about the CIA. I'll just make them up.
Yeah, for sure.
I was an agent in the CIA and the FSB.
But yeah, I mean, seriously, I mean, if you're not in a position to donate financially, click the like button. It doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, that's
good. Leave a comment. Share.
Sharing is huge, actually.
Those are all things that you're able to do that doesn't cost you a dime, that helps out immensely.
Also, if you're like close to a high profile podcaster, like a Tucker Carlson or someone like that, and you want to have JT on, suggest to them that JT or myself or both of us come on as guests, that also, the cross-pollination helps enormously.
It helps. Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So let's go back to the other questions here. In response to Trump's presidency, this is from Palmisano. How far do you think the pendulum will swing in the opposite direction if a Democrat becomes president next?
I haven't seen anything to indicate that there is a Democrat that's viable in a way that is an opposition to Trump. Meaning, I haven't seen, it's not like I've seen, like, let's say, a Bernie Sanders-esque character that would be a pendulum swing to Trump, that was competent, that was willing to have those fights in the way that Trump is doing. I just don't see the balance here. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm missing something.
No, I mean, look, historically, there's never been one, right? I mean, people who are familiar with American politics know about the ratchet effect, right? So the Republicans move, when they get in, even someone like George W. Bush, who barely won the presidency by some standards, by my standards, did not win the presidency. He claimed a mandate, went hog wild, moved the country far to the right. Obama comes in and ticks back a little bit, but it mostly in style. Trump goes hog wild. Biden ticks back a little bit. Trump goes hog wild again. That's why the 50-yard line of American politics keeps scooting further and further to the right, year after year, decade after decade. So the odds that the next Democratic president, whether it be a Buttigieg or a Newsom or whoever, would go crazy like Trump, I mean, it's hard to imagine, right? Like, if I were, if President Rahl were to come in, I mean, first of all, I would need a compliant Congress that I was willing to terrorize the way that Trump has terrorized the GOP. It would have to be a hostile takeover of the Democratic Party. I would have to be a maniac who stayed up until all hours of the night, did rallies, did all sorts of shit like Trump. Just imagine a Democratic Trump who's ranting and raving about how we need socialism, we need socialized healthcare, we have to have free college, we have to have a $50 minimum wage, and just doesn't take no for an answer. Has the Democratic Party had a figure like that anywhere in their ranks since Huey Long? I don't know. Maybe FDR might have been the last one who was willing to try to pack the Supreme Court. You tell me.
Yeah, they don't believe in those things. I mean, that's what it boils down. Maybe. Well, back then, yeah, FDR did. I mean, but even FDR looked like, I mean, his thing was, I'm saving capitalism. He was like, I mean, keep in mind, FDR was around when the Soviet Revolution took place. And he saw the revolutions that was attempted in Germany or Italy, et cetera, et cetera. Like his thing was, I don't want this to happen in America. There was a Communist Party. There was a Socialist Party. There were these parties that were in the States that were agitating and that were pushing for the stuff. No, his response was, I need to do these things because if I don't, winter may be coming to America in this case, in the way that they were looking at it. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything like that from the Democratic side. You mentioned the ratchet effect. Basically, you know, the Republicans move it and Democrats lock it in. Republicans move, Democrats lock it in. And they continue to do this over and over and over again. And so a revitalization, put it this way, it would need to be something dramatic that would justify it in the eyes of the American public, where reporters who are asking, how do you pay for this, matters less than doing whatever the hell they're going to do. I hope you get what I mean. Like, meaning, if this creates oil shocks, where everything goes up in price, and people start losing their jobs, and the economy goes into a tailspin, and there's stagflation, you may get that guy. You may get that guy. Short of something like that, I don't see you getting that guy who's going to be the Trump on the other side of the ledger.
No, I agree. And also, I think quite privately, and maybe not so privately, the DNC, who runs the Democratic Party, they are a right-wing organization. They're corporatists. They share so much in common ideologically and politically with the Republicans. They're not going to push back hard because they like the tax cuts for the rich. They, you know, that's why they always, they like the wars. They love that shit, right? It's all the same. So, I mean, that's this is a very interesting comment, by the way. Phileas Fogg says that parties become increasingly similar because of a mathematical idea called Hodling's Law. So are you familiar?
I've heard the logic of why parties end up becoming similar. And with the idea that it's when the center fails that you get the wings of the party that starts coming into play. Like, meaning it's the fact that the Democratic Party and Republican Party failed and lost credibility in the eyes of the American public, that you get people like Sanders and Trump, who under normal circumstances wouldn't be considered viable candidates, but became viable because the center failed. From my understanding, it's something to the effect of the parties are similar because you need that stability, that you don't want these kind of wild swings in the political space. And the similarities, if something works, the other one kind of mimics the fact that something works. But I can only paraphrase it. I don't know it specifically in the way that pretty sure there's a better definition for what I'm trying to explain.
Well, I'm cheating. I looked it up on Wikipedia, right? So Hodling's Law, which is also known as the principle of minimum differentiation, is an economic observation that competing companies tend to make their products, locations, or political stances as similar as possible to maximize market share. Example that they give, imagine a beach with customers spread evenly, two ice cream vendors, rather than separating to minimize customer walking distance, will both move to the center to try to capture the largest possible customer base. So I would say that there's a tendency there. So Hodling's Law applies to the American two-party system nicely under circumstances where there is a large center among the electorate, right? That's not the case now, though. I mean, now we have like a instead we have an inverted bell curve. The center is being hollowed out. Our politics are far more polarized. There's far more people, I would say, not like the far left, sadly for my people, but in the progressive left, the Bernie Sanders people basically used to be 1960s liberal Democrats like Hubert Humphrey. There's a lot more people there and on the MAGA right, like the true America First right, than there are in the squishy middle. And I think that's part of what we're seeing is like, so we've inherited a system where especially the Democratic Party hasn't really gotten the memo. But also, I don't think the Democratic Party is really as interested in votes as they are in corporate donations. They, you know, they're okay losing because they can campaign and fundraise on being out of power. And that's, Republicans are more after the votes because demographically, they have to be. There are fewer registered Republicans than registered Democrats. I mean, and I think also going through a radical realignment on par with like the 1928-1932 realignment. So where, you know, for people who aren't familiar, basically the Republicans were the liberal party before that. And then FDR and Al Smith kind of changed all that and made the Democratic Party the more liberal party.
Also, Democrats have a contradiction built into them that Republicans just don't have to deal with. I mean, how are you the release valve to capitalism while simultaneously taking billions from the same capitalists? Like, meaning, how do I take policy that cuts in a particular direction in the benefit of the poor in the way that I describe myself? Meaning, because they're still living off the reputation of FDR. And so it's like, how do you do that while simultaneously taking huge amounts of money from those same people? You're crippled by it. There's a contradiction in the way that you are claiming to operate versus the way you actually operate. And I don't know how you mind that gap in a way that makes you an effective party.
So interesting that right now, even as we were talking this morning on the regular show as our lead story, Donald Trump today really totally went, he violated that rule. Right, Republicans now are wallowing in that same incongruity that's been afflicting Democrats for years. And now, because the whole shtick of Trumpism is, I care about you, they care about they them, they care about weirdos, they care about foreign wars, I care about your ability, the price of eggs. Remember that? I care about the price of eggs. Now he's like, I don't care about the price of eggs or the price of gas or the price of anything else or your salary or your lack thereof. He said it out loud. All I care about is doing this war for Israel so that Iran can't get a nuclear weapon, which they don't want and can't get anyway.
Right. They need to get it now. I mean, to be honest, it was a serious dereliction of responsibility for Iran not to have a nuke.
Oh, no, I mean, I would have to say they've gone full retard if they're not behind the scenes, like, yeah, we're going.
Yeah, we're going for it. It's like North Korea, the Korean model was the right model, right?
Yeah,
North Korea was like, we got a missile, don't fuck with us.
Yeah. I'm on Team Un on this all the way, right? Stormborn 8686, thanks so much for the $5. $5 just because. I came for John and stayed for Ted, Jamarl, and Robbie, and the Rumble Chats. Rumble Chats are good. Maybe Booth Funk, same here. Thanks for the $10. Svensson, thanks for the $10 also. I love your show, even though I don't always agree with your views. I watch a lot of stuff that I don't agree with the views either. I really appreciate your content. I look forward to watching your show daily. I came for John and stayed for you all. Thank you. Alex, 49, love bombing us $10. We love you guys too. Thank you. I'm always in awe. We have the best fans. So let's see. Okay, 14 more minutes. Robbie, do we have any more? Do we have any more comments here?
We just got another $20 donation from GVMan43, just because I love you all. We love you too.
Thank you.
Yep. And I'm going to share the link to the channel's Discord server again here real quick. So I've not done that in a while. We do.
Oh,
we do. Cool. We do have a Discord server. I'll drop it here in the old Rumble chat.
Okay.
By the way, I got a very nice email from one of the audience members saying,
"Oh, really?"
Basically, effectively, they were there with John and everything else. They enjoyed the show. They liked me as an addition. I want to give that guy a shout out. So, thank you for that. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate it.
No, people are really liking you, JT. And I'm one of them.
Oh, thanks, Robbie.
I mean, you're wrong, but I still like you.
That's fine. That's totally fine. That's totally fine.
Oh, and by the way, people were asking, like, well, how much are we making now by comparison? I mean, we're in the toilet now. I think we're like around $3,000 a month from, as opposed to, we fell off a cliff after John left.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, honestly, we're just trying to figure out what the floor is, because we got a lot of people, because on YouTube, the algorithm's still factoring in John's people. A lot of people are unfollowing, they're unsubscribing. And when that happens, YouTube's algorithm, of course, is going to push it down. A lot of people are saying, but we're not getting notified when the show goes live. Well, that's because YouTube sees those numbers going down. No, John is a internet phenomenon. And if one day you're pulling in 4,000 people in a live stream, the next day you're pulling in 200, after a couple of weeks, YouTube is trying to figure out, they're trying to reevaluate how profitable the show is this, how viable is it going to be, how hard should we promote it, how hard should we push it. Rumble doesn't do that. If you go live, they notify you if you have the Rumble app installed, whereas YouTube doesn't. It's just one of the differences between the two platforms. But there's a reason why I suspended Robbiegate. I cannot, in good conscience, ask people to crowdfund the work that I do while the co-hosts who make the show work are getting a nice cold shower. I'm not going to do that. It would not be right. It would be an incredibly dick move on my part. So instead, I'll shamelessly plug Putin by gaming. So go follow on Rumble, and whenever I stream, come by and say hi. We'll talk politics, whatever. It's only on Rumble, and we'll talk about whatever. Killing pixels, AI porn, aliens. It doesn't matter. We'll figure something out.
Okay.
AI porn is weird.
It is so bizarre. Yeah. Robbie, what do you think about the White House correspondent dinner shooter bringing a shotgun and six knives to the stage? I'm sure than one another assault rifle to be used in a public shooting. We're on YouTube, so I'd be careful about how I would say this. If I was going to be doing something like that, a shotgun would not be what I would use.
Shotgun's weird.
Well, he explained this in his note.
Yeah. I mean, if
he said, he was worried about, what's the word I would say? Collateral damage. He wanted to go out to kill the people he wanted to kill. He somehow, Kash Patel gets a free pass, right? Was it? but he did not want to kill Kash Patel, but he was like, he didn't say who he did want to kill. We can speculate on that, but he said, I want to kill the people I want to kill. I don't want to kill innocent bystanders. And he thought that coming heavier was going to risk that.
No, well, a shotgun's not.
Yeah, a shotgun. That's very strange to do that with. I mean, did he really think he was going to be able to get to the president by himself? Usually in movies, you have to go through a lot of people before you get to the big guy, right?
Well, clearly that's the case here.
Well, the thing is, a shotgun's not going to defeat body armor.
Yeah.
So if that's what you're going to use, so typically you're trained to shoot center mass. You got to be careful what I say here because we're all on YouTube. That's not going to work with a shotgun because a shotgun cannot defeat body armor. A knife can. That's why I had knives, because bullets, they blunt out. They flatten out whenever they hit something. So if you shoot a bucket of water with a rifle, you can actually pick the bullet up out of the bottom of the the barrel because the bullet itself flattens. Knives defeat body armor, but you have to get in close. Tell you what, follow me at Putin by Gaming, and when we're here on Rumble, I would tell you what I would do if I ever decided to go on a homicidal rage and defeat body armor. But I can't do it here because I 100% get banned.
No, but you will not allow me. I will, because I will just go like this, and then you'll, that'll be that.
Done!
Okay. All right.
Damn communists.
All right. With that, yeah, well, you know our censoring ways. Thanks so much for $5, Manchild. Any other fascinating stories we are missing? I'm still kind of taken by this viscosity story, but what about viscosity? You?
What do you mean?
Well, so yesterday on TMI, Robbie and I talked about the study that came out 3 years ago that finds that the viscosity of liquids, water, et cetera, is absolutely determines what you, like the ability of things to function in our universe and be alive. And that it turns out that the amount of viscosity in our universe is kind of hits the sweet spot for life in plants and animals. And
oh, stuff. Yeah, right. You know, I mean, but that's everything, though.
It if blood were much thicker, it wouldn't work. If it was much thinner, it wouldn't work. If sap was too thin, you know, like that. Everything, it's like viscosity is super important. We always focus on the big stuff, but it's that stuff at the, you know, it's that physical constant at a very baseline level that's super important. We don't think about viscosity. It's in our lives all the time, right? Like when you're pouring milk or whatever, but we don't think about it.
It's not just viscosity, though. It's everything is fine-tuned. I mean, if you think of like the electrostatic charge, just like stuff like that, photoelectric effect, like the strong nuclear force, like all of these little things are like very fine-tuned for life. I mean, and you can make the argument that it's fine-tuned that way because life wouldn't exist without it being fine-tuned that way. Like we just found the universe where like life evolves and we can evolve in the context of being in this particular reality. I know some people can invoke God, and I don't mean that as a negative. I just mean, like when you're looking at a universe that seems to be fine-tuned for life in this way, the first thing people think is like, hey, how did it get that way? Right.
You know, I thought about something pursuant to the question earlier about like how much the show makes, how much the show needs. You know, I used to work at on Wall Street. I was a trader trainee in the 80s at Bear Stearns. And it's the only company I ever worked where it was considered completely normal and part of the culture to tell everybody how much you earned. How much do you make? Oh, I make, you know, I made $10,000 a year. It's like, how much do you make? 14,000. Oh, how much do you make? 32. And like, we were all able to, it was like, because you're dealing in money, right, all day long, it was part of the culture. And the boss hated it. He's like, it's unprofessional to talk about how much you make. We'd be like, fuck you, Sal. You just don't want us to know because you don't want, because you want to play us off against each other, right? Yeah. So it kind of gives me, I was kind of reminded of that, just sort of thinking about, you know, that question. Like, if people knew how much fucking Pandora underpaid musicians, they might not use it, right? I mean, because it's actually heinous, or Spotify. If people knew how little YouTube paid creators, they might just hate it, right? But like, basically, we all kind of like pretend like, oh, we're doing okay, when really we're barely hanging on by the hairs on our chinny chin chin, right? We're barely hanging on, scraping by, you know, begging, stealing, and borrowing to pay our bills, and we don't talk about it because in America that's somehow like considered rude. I mean, it seems to me like it's a capitalist ruse to keep us poor. I mean, knowledge is power, and on all things, including money. Sorry, I just had to have that rant.
No, you're right. I mean, you're totally right. It's just, I don't even know if it's impolite or if it's just, I don't know, it feels awkward to do so. I don't know. But you're right. I mean, YouTube clearly underpays creators. Google is making buck off of things and everything that people are effectively doing. I mean, if you think of all of it, like Facebook, Twitter, all of this stuff is intellectual property. None of these things have business models without public being willing to put their information and commentary and everything else on. And yet we pay them for the service to do it. It's just wild. Yeah. The idea you have to pay Twitter to get a blue check mark when Twitter doesn't exist without you putting your content on it. I mean, this is kind of like the Jeff Bezos thing, right? Jeff Bezos, regardless of whatever idea he has for Amazon, he'll be sitting in a factory by himself without workers and whatnot. We tend to be the workers on Twitter, every bit as much as the people who are working on Twitter. And yeah, I get that they're creating an entity for people to use, but they don't have an entity without people using that entity in the first place. I don't know. It's very strange. I get your point. And you're right. We don't talk about it.
We should talk about it. There's no reason not to. I mean,
yeah. You know. Feels awkward.
Hey, but no, you're right. Philip Blair has a good question. On stories not covered, U.S. opens military action in Ecuador against quote-unquote terrorist organizations, New York Times. What's the untold story here? Are they trying to suppress indigenous people? This reminds me of the Stephen Donziger story. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
Yes. Yes. Steve, I've had him on the show. I've interviewed him.
He lives right across the street from my apartment.
Is he?
I've been to his place while he was under house arrest. I mean, so Stephen Donziger, for people who are unfamiliar, is an attorney. They're going to say former attorney. I say he should still be an attorney, who battled Chevron representing indigenous people in Ecuador. And basically, oil drilling from Chevron caused massive pollution, cancer, environmental degradation, starvation on the part of all these indigenous people in Ecuador. He represented them. He went to court in Ecuador and kicked Chevron's ass and won the biggest verdict in the history of the world. $9.5 billion, that would be worth $13 billion today. So what happens when you, I mean, let's face it, Chevron has more wealth than many nations, okay? It is a transnational monolith that is, it's almost incomprehensible. I bet there are people who work at the highest levels of Chevron who don't really completely comprehend how massive they are, right? Anyway, they went to war against Donziger. They decided to destroy him. They basically bought a corrupt judge in the United States, flipped the script, and basically claimed falsely that he had bribed the judge in Ecuador and had corrupted the jury to get the giant jury verdict, even though he wasn't sharing in any of it, and had him sent to prison, and then. That was reduced to house arrest for years, where he had to live in his apartment across the street from my place. It's like that. It's actually insane. Now the thing is, the U.S. court had no standing whatsoever. Let's just say Donziger, for the sake of argument, had done what was alleged that he had bribed a jury or a judge or both in Ecuador. Well, that's for the Ecuadorian authorities to adjudicate, right? That has nothing to do with us. Who gives a shit? But anyway, they went after him. They destroyed him. They had him disbarred. They did everything they possibly could to ruin his life. Now he can walk free in the neighborhood. But holy shit! I mean, so I got to say, I smell a big Chevron-y Ecuadorian rat here. How about you?
Well, that case was mind blowing. I remember reviewing that case, and I thought to myself, how the fuck does this happen? It's shocking what they were able to do with him. I mean, you had a private company that effectively put a lawsuit, with legal consequences against him, that put him in jail. And as you pointed out, house arrest at a certain point, but just the fact that it happened was mind blowing. So no, I agree with you. The Ecuador thing is fascinating. Ecuador used to be a really good country. And I'm saying this as somebody who's been to Ecuador, who enjoyed it at the time where it was not a drug haven with effectively killings of political people who are running for presidential elections, which is what happened last time. You know, when Correa was there, do you remember this Correa, the one who effectively kept Julian Assange, effectively gave him political protection in the embassy. That was Correa.
Socialist guy.
Right. When Correa's vice president, Moreno, took office, Moreno bent over, spread eagle for the U.S. to, you know, effectively take advantage of him.
And yeah, that's how Assange got evicted.
Exactly, in unsavory ways. Moreno was like, Assange is a rock in my shoe. And the U.S. was effectively applying all sorts of pressure to Moreno and ends up going after Correa after the fact. We're trying to prosecute him.
No bad deed goes unpunished, maybe.
Effectively, right. They were pissed off that he was protecting Julian Assange, in which case, once he got out of office, they tried to go after him once mm-hmm. he got out of office. So Ecuador radically changed between that time period, in which case they became somewhat of a vassal. So, yeah, it's not a pretty picture. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they've destroyed the state. You have drug gangs that are just running rampant. Criminality is running the roost. And yeah, at this point, these guys are patsies for the U.S. government. So yeah, they've changed.
Any more before we wrap it up, Robbie?
I am checking something. Looks like we may have some breaking news. Just one second. I am doing some fact checking here. We may know why that Macron got slapped by his husband.
What?
Yes. So I think that Brigitte is a dude. I think that's probably accurate.
You're gonna get sued.
Maybe
Brigitte is not only. I bet she's not only a woman, but I bet she's great in bed. But also, crazy.
Would that right?
Okay. So it looks like the Times. The Times.com says Brigitte Macron slapped her husband or his husband. Pick your pronoun over texts that he sent to Iranian film star Golshef Farahmani. So it looks like he may have been sexting a younger and hotter Iranian actress.
What?
Wait, what's the act? Yes. I gotta like find this whole.
Yeah, we gotta look her up. Hold on, I got you. I have got you.
Picture of her up.
Yeah, I want a picture.
Check the deprogram chat.
Because Bridget is a strong woman who I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so this is the Times this is the London Times or what used to be called the Times of London.
Yeah, if you click on it, you'll see a picture of this lady and. She's definitely easier on the eyes than Macron's husband is. I'm just going to put that out there.
She is not unattractive. That's true.
No,
let's see if I can put her up in the Rumble studio because I have not done this.
You would click on it and then you click on presentation mode and then you could. Projected up onto the screen.
Oh my God, that's a pain in the ass. Really? Get out
of here. Wait, that what? Shit is humiliating.
No, I have a better way. I know what I can do. I just make it an overlay. There you go. And then I'll just erase it later.
Yeah, there are options.
Yeah, there are options. It's not letting me do that.
Thing.
No, click on presentation or screen share. And then presentation. You said, may I should let me do it? Hold on.
Now, where's screen share? That's what I was looking for earlier.
Hold on. Let's see. Okay, so screen share is there at the bottom right corner. Home. One second here. I got y'all. I got
getting
you.
Stuff like that in public as I, president is humiliating.
I got there you here. All right, so y'all should let me scroll down here. There's the ad.
There it is.
And it looks like that is her. Let's see,
I'm sure Emmanuel Macron, as a Frenchman, and the French are well known for not being interested in sex or romance, probably was only interested in her for her acting abilities and was trying probably to get, like, to find out if she's willing to come to France. And work with the French film industry.
So on the screen right now, y'all see Brigitte,
mm-hmm.
and I'll scroll back up
mm-hmm.
to the Iranian. So y'all tell me, what would
well, personally, I'd go for Brigitte, but that's the way I roll.
I'm just going to say Brigitte is a very strong woman.
Yeah, that goes a lot. That goes a long way with me, and you know, and having a long history of having been abused.
I used to make the joke that Macron was an abused, was a battered spouse.
Yeah, and, oh, he was, and I'd be like, you know, yeah, I'm familiar. I know what that's like. All right, that's fine.
Yeah, that would be terrifying.
But that is what we got here. So let me.
All right, I'm
like somebody can save Macron.
I'm taking her out. All right, cool.
And get beat by his wife. Well,
with that seems like an amusing and oddly appropriate way to end this show. We will be back tomorrow at Thursday, 9 a.m. So 9 a.m. deprogram, 10 a.m. TMI, 11 a.m. DMZ America with Scott Stantis. Keep it right here, and thanks all.
We've got to cover Macron on TMI tomorrow. I think he's doing.
I want to find out. You know what I really wish? I wish we had bumper music. You know, like on the radio, I used to be able to program all of, you know, anything like this, right? Like, so I might have played Devo, Whip It Good, like at the end of the segment.
Oh.
You know, I don't know exactly like SAG-AFTRA or what, you know, what kind of like BMI rights they're paying for to be able to do that. But we didn't have to ask permission. We just did it, you know, anything we wanted.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll figure it out.
All right, well, we will figure it out.
Y'all have a good one.
You too. Have a good day. See you tomorrow. Bye, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.